This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll be joined by Naomi Wolf, feminist, social critic, and political activist.
Naomi sees what most Americans are blind to, that this country is well on the road to taking 10 steps toward a fascist state.
We talk with Professor John Ehrenberg, author of Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Equality. It's a powerful discussion chronicling the right-wing strategy to amass and protect their fortunes, wielding dangerous ideology and legislation. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Director of the USA Program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
As expected, the U.S. media responded with front page damning coverage, cliched coverage of what Fidel's reign in Cuba has signified.
Heidi, you and the president of the National Lawyers Guild, Marjorie Cohn, wrote quite a beautiful letter, I thought, to the Cuban mission. And I wondered whether you'd read that short letter for our audience.
The National Lawyers Guild sends its warmest wishes to all of our Cuban colleagues and friends after hearing the news earlier today that Fidel Castro will neither seek nor accept another term as president of the State Council of Cuba. We are assured that the passion for socialism will continue to flourish in the hearts and minds of all Cubans, as it has for the last half a century. The spirit of revolution is institutionalized in the Cuban people. A spirit that has thrived for decades under the leadership of Comandante Fidel Castro. Over the past several decades, Guild members have had the pleasure of working closely with our Cuban friends. We have learned a great deal from the leadership of your island nation, which has provided education, health care, and housing for all its citizens, despite great hardship imposed on it by the government of the United States. Your revolutionary spirit has inspired us to pursue our work on behalf of social justice. We know that under the leadership of Fidel's successor, we shall continue to be equally encouraged to follow in your footsteps with the integrity that has characterized the Cuban way of life.
A couple of things were interesting in the coverage, even in the progressive media. Of course, some of the coverage said that he resigned. He actually didn't resign. He's simply not running for president again, and the election actually happened last Sunday. So it was wrong that he resigned. That's the first thing. The other thing that was interesting in the Times coverage to me, I read the article and they talked about how they're interviewing people on the streets in Cuba and what did they think. They said the older people were still supported, the younger people were more mixed about it, but that some people were afraid to give their names and they don't have democracy in Cuba and all this. And then they did an interview in Miami and they interviewed people and they interviewed someone on Calle Ocho, which has a store, which is the main store through the Cuban part of Miami. And that person also was afraid to give her name. But that person was afraid to give her name because she was afraid of retribution from the Cuban community within Miami. So here the Times on one hand is condemning Cuba for not having democracy, but really looking the other way when it comes to the fact there's actually no ability to exercise the First Amendment in Miami.
I just want to say a word for Cuba on the question of democracy. Their system is not perfect and isn't something I would necessarily recommend for others, but it's their system. And it's their system that they created in the face of an American blockade and attacks that have gone on ever since 1959. They have elections. They don't have parties. They're afraid that if they had competing parties, the United States would set up a party and try to take power and restore capitalism to Cuba. Is that bad? Yeah, I wish they did have parties. On the other hand, I don't think you can make a serious argument that the United States has parties either. You have these various indistinguishable entities that are running for office to preside over a single ideology system. So I don't think the United States has any right to criticize Cuba for what it's had to do. And I only hope that if there is a new regime in the United States, they lift the travel ban so Americans can go down there and see what it's like.
As I said, I think, to listeners the other day, I was there over Christmas. And once again, I just found it, you know, fantastic. The friendliness of the people, I had my children there, they were just incredible. And of course, you still have a system that believes that fundamental economic rights come first, that you get education, get health care, you get housing, and that after that, you can start talking about being a free citizen and exercising rights, something we could learn a lot from in the United States.
When you get to Cuba, there are no advertisements anywhere. There are political ads, which we love, but the kind of commercialism that pervades United States life is missing there, and that's a really refreshing thing that you don't notice how much we're assaulted by advertisements in this country until you go somewhere where there are none.
They have tried, in the teeth of really the largest economy ever organized, that's the economy of the United States, they've tried, despite that opposition by the American economy, to create a different kind of society, socialist men and women. Have they done it? No. They know very well how far short they are. But they're trying. And they're trying to set an example for the rest of the world that another way is possible.
During our recent fundraiser for Pacifica's WBAI 99.5 in New York City, we were live in the studio with Naomi Wolf. Naomi Wolf is a feminist, social critic, and political activist. The New York Times called her former book, The Beauty Myth, one of the most important books of the 20th century. She is the co-founder of the Woodhull Institute for Ethical Leadership, teaching young women to become leaders and agents of change. Her latest book, The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, is a call to return to the beliefs of our founding fathers. Her new book illustrates 10 steps historically taken by leaders who are attempting to dismantle a democracy. Wolf jokingly called it the greatest hits of fascism.
Now, Naomi Wolf is here with us in the studio, which is absolutely wonderful. Naomi, I've known of for a very long time. Wrote what many people consider one of the most important books of the 20th century, actually, called The Beauty Myth. When was that written, Naomi? I don't remember.
Oh, gosh, I was a baby, 1993.
Well, now I have to give it to my 17-year-old daughter who's
yes.
going through all
yes,
these kinds
do.
Of issues.
Yes, you do. Uh-huh.
So The Beauty Myth is one of the great books, really, that talks about, I mean, the way it was written here, it says post-feminism, feminism, but I don't know what that means.
Nah,
no,
it's all feminism. Yeah.
But anyway, Naomi Wolf wrote that book, which is, as I said, extraordinary. She's the founder of a place called the Woodhull Institute, which is also amazing. Why don't you say a word about that, Naomi?
Sure. It's very wonderful. Like WBAI, it's one of those institutions that tries to protect civil society when civil society is under threat. And it's an organization that teaches ethical leadership to young people. We have a focus with young women, but we've also had young men. And the idea is to empower young people to essentially helm the heads of arts and media, politics and law, business and entrepreneurship, but engage in ethical decision making. The idea is to run the world with people who actually care about social justice.
Quite remarkable. In fact, the book that Naomi is going to talk about today is called The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. Its cover is a lot like the old Common Sense by Tom Paine, and I'm sure you can talk about that a little bit. But why don't you tell us how you got to write this book and what the sort of point of the book is at this point?
I will. Thank you. And you're absolutely right. There is a real young patriot. His name is Chris Lee. His Vietnamese name was Vu. And I wrote it for him because he was about to marry one of our young graduates. And I realized, because I'd been reading the histories of mid-20th century society's closing, I realized that I didn't just need to give them, something from Crate and Barrel. I needed to give them something that I know you deal with all the time, which is the need for a primer for ordinary citizens, not constitutional scholars, about what is democracy and how to sustain it. What did the founders intend? How does the Bill of Rights actually keep us safe? How does the Constitution protect us? As well as a quick guide to the blueprint. It's essentially a simple blueprint that despots use to close down open societies.
The title is quite provocative because it's The End of America. And so what is the point of that title? I mean, what is it about? Are we really talking about a situation where we could see at least the end of America as we know it?
Yeah, and you'll have to forgive me for being a little bit shell-shocked this morning. I've just come back from a week traveling across the country, really for the first time with this book, talking to audiences about this message. And I almost hoped when I wrote this book that it would be looking ahead to a possible but avertible future that we need to take action about to forestall. But unfortunately, I've really come to realize on this journey across the country that the future is here and the time to rise up is, you know, last week. Yes, I'm talking about the end of America as we know it, meaning the end of liberty, the end of citizens being able to express themselves freely without fear of the state retribution in some scary way. And America based on the vision that the founding fathers passed down to us, an America of checks and balances. And yes, the end of America is when people really don't understand what a closed society looks like or how a democracy closes. A democracy, history shows, doesn't have to close in a violent coup. A democracy can be closed fairly easily when would-be despots do 10 key things. And while it's happening, it's not overnight. It's incremental. It's not even a diagonal line where you can say, oh, this is what's happening steadily. It's more like a series of tipping points. And from what I've heard from Americans across the country, and Americans, I want to stress, from all walks of life, Republicans are as freaked out about this in my travels outside the Beltway as Democrats are, is that these tipping points are happening now. Basically, the great dictators of the mid-20th century figured out a blueprint for how to close down a democracy through this series of assaults. And petty dictators kind of, you know, follow the blueprint less spectacularly. I mean, we teach the blueprint at the School for the Americas. And what happens in the blueprint is when a certain point has been reached, it is very hard for democracy to heal democracy. And so we're seeing these assaults right now.
We're with Naomi Wolf, the author of The End of America.
Yeah, can I just chime in? You know, this is so important that your listeners and all their friends and family support you guys. And it's not just the programming. It's so important because it is so clear to me that as we move into this stage of aggressive crackdown against democracy, these islands of free speech are more important than ever. They're at the forefront. But also people like you guys who are leading the fight to restore the rule of law and to let people know what the rule of law looks like are really the heroes and at the forefront.
Naomi, I just want to remind our audience that you've written The End of America. What's interesting to me about this book, a number of things are interesting, but one of the things is that it's published by Chelsea Green Publishing, which published our own Michael Ratner's book. Michael and Ellen Ray did a book on Guantanamo, torture and what's going on at Guantanamo.
Which I drew on heavily, by the way, in my section on torture.
And Chelsea Green is one of those publishing houses that we really have to be grateful to. And they donated a bunch of books for us to give out as premiums here. And secondly, this book is not just a book. It's a book that asks people to do something. It's a book that promotes the American Freedom Campaign. We're going to put up the American Freedom Campaign's website on our website.
Thank you.
Michael, tell us about the American Freedom Campaign, because I know the Center for Constitutional Rights is involved in it.
Yeah, we're happy to be involved in it. I'm going to let Naomi describe it. We haven't gotten to her book yet, but why don't you describe the American Freedom Campaign, what its website is, and tell people what they can do.
Very important. Okay, so we do need, I mean, history shows when there's an aggressive crackdown against democracy that really the only thing to save a country and to save a democracy is an aggressive grassroots democracy movement. And how ironic that we need one in the United States of America right now, but we do. So the American Freedom Campaign is a new organization, not so new by now, a few months old, where very brave people from many key organizations, but also thousands and thousands of grassroots citizens, patriots, have joined together to basically drive an aggressive democracy movement to restore the Constitution and the rule of law and to hold our lawmakers accountable to doing the minimum to restore the Constitution. And we're honored to have Michael Ratner and the Center for Constitutional Rights as one of our partner organizations. We have Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Move On, I believe the National Lawyers Guild has
the
just
National
come on.
Lawyers Guild.
Thank
That's
you.
Us.
They're talking to us. I shouldn't be premature until I have formal confirmation.
There
but
she is, the executive director.
Sounds like a right match to me.
Right.
Okay, well, let's chat off the air. But we're reaching out across the spectrum on the left. There's a parallel organization on the right called the American Freedom Agenda. And what you know, what we've got is a 10-point legislative package that you can see on the website. Some of these, I mean, I remember turning to Michael Ratner and saying, what, you know, if we could turn to the American people and say, what gift could we give you and your brave lawyers at the Center for Constitutional Rights to help you? He said, like, what's your wish list? He said, restore habeas corpus. So that's on the 10-point agenda. You know, other key things like keep the government from breaking into our homes, tapping our phones and emails, seizing our computers without a court order on the president's say-so alone, forbid kidnapping, detaining, torturing people, and the abuse of signing statements, prohibit military commissions, and keep journalists from being prosecuted under the Espionage Act for reporting on classified information. I just had a lovely evening with Daniel Ellsberg and his beautiful wife in Berkeley, and he chilled me by saying that the things that the government did to him, like illegal wiretapping, trying to intimidate him with a bunch of thugs, you know, breaking into his shrink's office and stealing, you know, confidential records, those things are legal now. And they led to the impeachment of a president, you know, back when we had a strong democracy. So I guess what I also want to say about this is we're, as I've traveled across the country, people are glad that there's a democracy movement that is coalescing like this. And I do think we're making a difference. We put a pledge to basically protect the Constitution to all the presidential candidates on the Democratic side. And most of them signed up except the front runners, Hillary and Obama. And finally, there was a lot of pressure on them from this campaign. Finally, they signed the pledge. And Hillary moved in her public assertions about torture from a shocking position of, yes, it's okay sometimes, the fake ticking time bomb scenario, to now she's out there saying all torture is wrong. So that's movement. This shows what you can do when you get, you know, millions of Americans or thousands and thousands of Americans pushing. But I mean, what I'm hearing from people is that it's not enough.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. We're speaking with social critic and political activist Naomi Wolf about her latest book, The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot.
When I say I'm a little shell-shocked, you know, I've been traveling across the country and there have been packed crowds. And it's not that I'm so interesting. It's that people know that there's a crisis. And these crowds are across the political spectrum. And they're like, I tell them, well, we have this movement. It's a 10-point agenda. And write your congressman. And they're like, fine, that is not enough. And then, okay, so I'm jumping ahead a little, but it seems clear to me that crimes are being committed, okay? And you guys talked about, and I'm dying to get my hands on this, a lineup of a principled argument about criminality. And again, looking at the historical record, at this point where this I'm worried about Blackwater. I mean, I'm moving ahead quite a bit, but Blackwater massacred 17 people in Iraq, and the state is protecting them. This is what you do in Germany. This is what happens in Italy. The state protects the thugs, the murderers, the torturers. And once you cross that line, you know, it doesn't matter how much of civil society is intact because people just get scared. And so Blackwater could be deployed in Times Square tomorrow, as I understand the law. They were already in New Orleans. They've got a $1 billion contract to deploy more widely in the United States.
Let me remind people, we're listening to Naomi Wolf, The End of America, a crucial piece of reading.
Thank you. So to pick up, you know, if their business model calls for expanded deployment in the United States in the event of a natural disaster or, quote unquote, a public emergency. And as of the 2007 Defense Authorization Act, now the president has enhanced powers to declare a public emergency. So this is not happy, looking at the historical blueprint, and our timeline is tighter than I thought it was when I wrote this book. So I guess I want to ask you guys, because you're all lawyers, as I understand it, and I'm not. People are asking me to ask you, how do we prosecute? Because we don't have time.
You know, you prosecute if you have a mass movement behind you and if you have the power behind you.
Is that correct?
Well, as a practical matter.
In this country, it's very difficult, obviously. I mean, what we have done in this country is we, criminal cases are, you have to go to the prosecutor. So that's a big problem.
Right.
You have to go to impeachment as another route.
Can you impeach and then prosecute? Because history shows that it's not enough to impeach. It isn't enough to impeach if you have violent criminals.
Once those two guys are out of office, Bush and Cheney, they can then be prosecuted.
Okay, so the steps to take are impeach, then prosecute. Is that correct?
That's if you want to do it here. That's correct.
Well, how else can one do it?
Now, I will say that in Europe, I just came back from Europe, and it was actually thrilling in a way. I mean, we filed a case in Germany that we lost against Rumsfeld. We're working on one possibly in Spain where there's Guantanamo detainees, and that may stick on torture. Mm-hmm. But, you know, 25 CIA agents have been indicted in Italy, and they're called...
No, I didn't know that.
And they're fugitives.
Whoa!
Alien
fugitives.
And the prosecutor, and I don't generally get along with prosecutors.
We'll give them a trial, though.
The Italian prosecutor was at our meeting and has a slideshow that I'm going to try and bring him here that shows how we track down these agents who kidnapped an Egyptian cleric off the streets of Milan and sent him to Egypt for torture.
Wow.
They've been indicted. 12 or so agents have been indicted in Germany for the kidnapping of Al-Masri, the German citizen who was taken, you know, off a bus in Macedonia and sent to a U.S. torture site in Afghanistan. So Europe now actually, it has some pluses and minuses going on among these issues, but actually there's some things going on. And those agents, this is great to me, Naomi, is those agents, to the extent we have their real names, or the prosecutor does, and he does in a number of cases, they now have arrest warrants operating in 140 countries.
Oh, my gosh. So, I've never heard this. There's like a news blackout in the U.S. about stuff like that.
Yeah.
Right. The first thing a would-be despot always does, and I want to reassure readers that what I did was I looked at societies where a would-be dictator sought either to close a democracy or to crush a pro-democracy movement. And it didn't matter if the would-be dictator was on the left or the right. It turns out they all do the same 10 things. And by the way, you know, I wrote this book not just for this young man, but for a slightly older family friend who's the daughter of Holocaust survivors. And again, I don't look at Germany lightly. I'm Jewish, and I would not, you know, I'm not using this example rhetorically at all. It's very technical. She is the daughter of Holocaust survivors, and she kept saying to me about news events, they did this in Germany, they did this in Germany. And I thought this was nuts for her to say. And I tried to brush it off, but she forced me to sit down and start reading some histories. And she didn't mean German outcomes, 38, 39. She didn't mean crematoria. She meant the early years, 1930, 31, 32. And people forget, you know, it was a fragile democracy, but it was a modern state with a parliament, a working parliament, a constitution, political parties, newspapers, Bauhaus design, Paris fashion, Page Six, celebrities. It wouldn't have looked so different from us. And people forget that in the early days of what I call a fascist shift, things look pretty normal. I realized that she was not wrong, that there were so many echoes, not just tactics, but actual legislation, actual sound bites, actual images being reproduced. It's almost like someone in the White House looked at the early years, you know, the greatest hits of fascism and totalitarianism, what worked, you know, and is recycling it.
The same words.
The first part of the book, right, is what you said is not the deepest part, which it isn't, but goes through some of the language, which is extraordinary.
It's shocking.
Homeland.
I mean, there are things we're hearing now that are right out of the 1930s, sleeper cells. Okay, so let me get to the first point. So every would-be dictator invokes a terrifying internal and external threat, and often it can be a real threat, which is hyped. For example, Stalin terrified Soviet citizens by talking about sleeper cells. Again, a term we didn't hear in the Clinton administration, even though Al-Qaeda was active in the Clinton administration. Sleeper cells, in Stalin's terms, were capitalist terrorists, us, basically, dressed like good Soviet citizens who were going to hide among good Soviet citizens till at a signal years later they would rise up and create terrorist mayhem. So this was fake, but it scared Soviet citizens. And Pinochet later, in 1973, invoked a real threat, armed insurgents. There were armed insurgents. But then he used fake documents, what he called Plan Z, which he showed on television, purporting to be documents about, again, a terror plot where these guys would rise up and bomb infrastructure, assassinate leaders. And we've seen false documents, very common to use false documents in a hyped threat. with the Panorama yellow cake fake documentation of this alleged uranium arms sale in Niger that was used by the White House to drive us into war. That's number one. The second thing a would-be despot always does is, and this is where talking to Michael Ratner has chilled me to bits, but so has the historical record, you create a secret prison system where torture takes place that's outside the rule of law, and often they create a military tribunal system that strips prisoners of due process. Lenin was the innovator. Mussolini looked at Lenin. These guys all studied each other. Stalin studied Hitler. Hitler studied Stalin. So, you know, Mussolini had the Confino system. Hitler had the people's courts. And what happens, why should we care about that? I mean, apart from the moral issue that we should care, a lot of decent Americans are like, whatever, that's not my issue, that they're torturing these alleged terrorists in Guantanamo. And by the way, don't believe the White House soundbite that we don't torture. It's torture. What they're doing is straight out of the Soviet gulag. I mean, these are techniques that were perfected in the Soviet gulag. What happens is that in a fascist shift, the state will start by torturing and abusing prisoners that most people don't identify with. Brown people on an island with scary Muslim names, right? Or in the early 30s, it was when torture was still technically illegal and the National Socialists weren't even a dominant power yet, the SA had these makeshift torture cellars and they took people that Germans were like, whatever, homosexuals, Jews, gypsies, whatever, anarchists, communists, whatever. And people knew about the torture. It was in cartoons. They were like, whatever.
For us to use, because we're really, what we're talking about is social change here. If you don't have democratic rights, you're not going to get social change.
That's right.
And
in either direction.
You know, just hypothetically say the United States and Israel starts bombing Iran 6 months from now. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge pouring out in all the major cities in America of an anti-war protest. Mm-hmm. And let's say there are 3 million people in New York and Washington combined. And what's the government going to do about this? Well, in the past, they've just hunkered down and eventually give up and withdraw to Vietnam. But maybe this time they're not going to do that. Mm. Maybe this time they pick up the phone and they call Eric Prince and they say, Prince, let's get some troops in here. We got a national emergency.
That's exactly
and maybe
right.
They invoke that law. Naomi, you talk about it. They actually have a detention center that's set up. They gave one of the big contractors,
Halliburton.
Kellogg, Brown & Root, yep. Division of Halliburton, $377 million to build the detention center in the event of a national emergency. And then they said, and it's not just for illegal immigrants. You know, who do you think they're talking about here? This station, they could pull the plug on this. They've already gotten the big internet companies on board. If we're communicating with each other to try to build the movement, they can turn the switch off. Mm-hmm. So I can't send a message over to Michael at AOL.
I just want to say, this kind of what if, it sounds kind of alarmist in a way, but it's so important to play out these scenarios because there's a section at the end of the book where I play out a number of these what ifs, all of them very probable based on the historical blueprint or plausible. The reason to play them out now and act to prevent them is that history shows that when there's this kind of sustained assault against democracy, suddenly things start to happen very, very quickly. And there's a kind of shock that sets in, and there's a kind of hangover. And that's really where we are now, because look at Congress. Congress keeps acting like it's a democracy, and the White House is just ignoring them. And this reminds me of this scene where Mussolini has already sent his black shirts to march on Rome. And Parliament is still trying to negotiate with him. They keep offering him cabinet positions. And he's just like drumming his fingers, waiting for them to realize that he, you know, the time for negotiating is over. So we've got to kind of wake up because this hangover period is very dangerous. And we have to put in place the basics of the rule of law to prevent these kinds of what-if scenarios.
Now, give your website, Naomi.
Okay, AmericanFreedomCampaign.org. So the third step is, yes, we talked about it, Blackwater, is to create a paramilitary force that's not answerable to the people. Now, why were the founders so concerned about the Second Amendment? And why did they say you can't have a standing army, you can't have a militia that's not answerable to the people? They had just come out of occupation by a hostile force where there was a standing army, where King George's men would break into their homes, go through their stuff. This is why blanket warrants are bad. This is what King George's men used to, you know, terrify the colonists, frighten their families. You know, women were molested and raped. You know, with a standing army, people get traumatized and intimidated very easily. And so they said, you can't have that. So with the 2007 Defense Authorization Act, apart from Blackwater being deployed, we've got a situation where now, totally in violation of what the founders envisioned, totally in violation of how they set us up to be free, the president can send the National Guard from Alabama to enforce a curfew on the people of New York or Oregon over the objections of the governors of Alabama and New York or Oregon, a federalized National Guard in effect, and tell Congress about it after the fact. So this is not what the founders meant when they said you can't have a standing army that terrifies the people.
I think it accelerated under Bush. I think it was a fantasy of Cheney and Addington going all the way back to the 70s. Huh. But I think it's been accruing, and I think it really accelerated after 9/11 when their program was handed to them on a silver platter. But, you know, one chilling thought is we could start a war against Iran without Congress stopping them, because Congress already said, if you want to do it, go ahead and do it. And the Democrats enabled them to do that. They've been kind of the handmaiden to the Republicans on this. And Congress, which is supposed to declare war, which is like the ultimate crunch in a society, hasn't declared a war since World War II.
Right.
Michael went to court on Congress's sitting on their hands when the executive under Reagan went to war in Central America several times.
Here's what we need to do, you guys. We don't have any time. There is no time. The time is now. Okay, first we have to harass and badger and oppress Congress, because they are criminally craven and compliant right now, to pass this 10-point legislative agenda. We have 130,000 signatures for the pledge. We need 5 million, you know, and we have 5 million members in partner organizations. We need 10 or 20 million. It has to become a majority groundswell. Now, people have been saying to me, what about a strike? I think nothing short of that, based on other democracy movements, is going to be effective. We're talking about November 6th, and Daniel Ellsberg talked about a moratorium, which was effective, one day of everyone not participating, then 2 days, then 3 days, just to indicate to everyone that there are millions of Americans who are going to, the way I'm phrasing it, is sit down for the Constitution. Not march, because it's too easy to get confronted by the police if you march, but millions of people, moms, housewives, dads, military guys, mainstream, bring American flags, sit down by the millions in some public place in your community all day on November 6th, after you vote, before you vote, and sit down for the Constitution. Then I think we need to, I'm trying to educate myself now, consulting with lawyers about how do we impeach and prosecute, and whom do we impeach and prosecute, and how, because really it is not safe to leave the country in the hands of these people, you know, until the next election. It's not safe to leave them in power another week. So wait. I just want to end by saying,
don't be
depressed. Don't be depressed. Be energized, because history also shows that bullies are cowards, and that when there is a democracy movement of people in their millions standing up to tyrants and oppressors, there is no power on earth that can stop them, especially now, because our democracy is not concluded. It is weakened, and we have the power to restore it.
Naomi, remind listeners of a website where they can get more information about how to join in on this.
Okay. It's AmericanFreedomCampaign.org, and the discussion about the moratorium is just beginning, and I'll keep people posted on the AFC website, and also I'll link to the Huffington Post and to FireDogLake.com.
That was Naomi Wolf talking about her recent book, The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
In their quest to shore up support for the politics of wealth and privilege, the right has organized patiently and consistently by focusing on a core ideology to amass a formidable base. The right's commentary on world affairs, morality, the state, and the economy has had an overarching focus, namely to eliminate social equality as a legitimate public policy goal. Its success has resulted in one of the most dramatic, undemocratic, and insidious transfers of wealth and power in recent American history. We are delighted to welcome political scientist John Ehrenberg, author of the book Servants of Wealth: The Right's Assault on Economic Justice. A professor of political science at Long Island University, in this, his third book, he critically analyzes the rise of an ideologically coherent right. He dissects their themes of military weakness, moral decay, racial anxiety, and hostility to social welfare to reveal their central organizing objective, protecting wealth and assaulting equality.
Professor John Ehrenberg, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to write Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Economic Justice.
I'm a political scientist by training and by profession. My area of specialization is ideology and political theory. So that explains a little bit about why I chose to attack this problem this way. I've been doing mostly scholarly work for these many years, and my wife has always been after me to write a clear, declarative, focused, and accessible treatment about what's been going on. And the more I thought about it and the more radical the Bush administration became, the more it occurred to me that somebody really had to account for the way in which for 25 years the right wing has managed to establish a real ideological and political and institutional base for itself. Part of the way it did that was in the realm of ideas. The left has often dismissed that by saying, well, all they had was money and all they had was brawn and we had the brains and the ideas. But that's really not what happened. And I think what we really have to take account of is that for 25 years, the right has been patiently organizing and paying close, clear attention to a distinct set of very core ideas around which it has constructed a very, very powerful movement. The core of the movement and the core of what's been going on is the upward distribution of wealth. And the United States now has the honor of being the most unequal advanced industrial nation on the planet, no matter how you measure it. This is not the result of economic growth. It's not the accidental result of the way the market works. It's the conscious, deliberate result of 25 years of social policy. And I felt I had to shine a light on that. So that's why I wrote the book.
Now, when you talk about that in the book, I guess one of the things you talk about is that that's not just the result of the free market, John, but you also talk about its relationship to the Constitution or constitutional crisis in this country. You sort of give our listeners the thesis of the book and what you're really trying to demonstrate.
The thesis of the book is that just as the creation of these vast disparities of wealth has been a political project, so is the solution to these vast disparities of wealth a political project. And the Greeks understood plutocracy as a government that was openly dedicated to the service of wealth. That's what we're becoming, and that's what's been developing for the last 25 years. As that's been happening and as the institutional base of the right narrows and narrows, it gets more and more radical. That's what's been happening certainly in the last 8 years of the Bush administration, and it's in that context that one can expect indifference to the Constitution, indifference to the rule of law, and a sense that these people really do believe that they can do whatever they want. When that's magnified by 9/11 and war, you get the constitutional crisis that we have now.
John, take us back 25 years, and how did this get started?
It starts with, in economic terms, it starts with the old crisis of Keynesianism at the end of the 1970s. And that's one thing I try to do in the book, is I try to account for a long economic crisis that creates the opportunity for ideas which had formerly been marginalized to suddenly acquire traction in a new environment. And if we're all kind of older in the tooth now than we were. So if you think back to the late 1970s and what it was like under Jimmy Carter, you have this long stagflation, which really, for very clear reasons, spells the end of Keynesian macroeconomic policies. And that is what opens the door to a new set of arguments about morality, about authority, about foreign policy, about the market, race, gender, which suddenly become very popular in the late 70s and early 80s.
I'm sort of simple here. Keynesian economic policy, my little bit of understanding is when there's things are going badly, you borrow money and you pump the economy up and give people jobs and work and Social Security and all these things. And when the economy gets better, then you pay back the debt. That's really what we're referring to?
That's part of it. That's a major piece of it. The major piece of Keynesian economics is that it is prejudiced in favor of the consumer. When Keynes tried to account for the Depression, his explanation for the Depression was not overproduction, but rather its obverse. It was underconsumption. Keynesianism tends to redistribute wealth and income downward. It doesn't do so in a radical way, but it is prejudiced in favor of large-scale mass consumption. And the large-scale mass consumers in a an industrial capitalist economy are to be found in the middle and the working classes. So the Keynesian period corresponds with a general equality of social relative equality of social conditions, certainly compared to what we have now. It's a period that Paul Krugman called the golden years of American capitalism. And by the end of the 1970s, that's coming under serious attack. So when Irving Kristol at the end of the 70s calls for business to organize itself politically, he senses an opportunity to have done with Keynesianism as a macroeconomic policy. And that's what begins the turn toward markets and toward the so-called trickle-down supply side.
So it's no longer really saying let's have at least a minimal social equality through whatever trickle-down, whatever else. But it's really saying we're done with that.
We're done with it.
And what's the new theory?
The new theory is, to the extent that it is a theory, is so-called supply-side economics or trickle-down economics. And that was articulated by people like George Gilder. And that became the ruling ideology of the Reagan administration and really has been the ruling ideology of every administration since then, moderated to some extent by Clinton. That policy seeks to reward wealth. And the policy is that the richer you make, the higher segments of the population, the more the economic benefits trickle down to those at the bottom.
So that's when we really see the tax cuts, the end of the estate tax, the attacks on Social Security. All those are related to really what happened at the end of the 70s, saying if we make businesses really rich and if we make people really rich, a few of them, and the argument is we won't really make people poor, we'll let it trickle down. But, of course, that's just a myth.
Exactly.
But as I understand it, what's happened has been a tremendous shift of wealth from the bottom to the top, particularly to the top, say, 1% in the last 25 years. What is the extent of this inequality now, and what direction do you see it's going in?
Well, the numbers vary from analyst to analyst, but they all agree on one thing, and it's the top 1%, but even more, it's the top 0.1%. It's the families with an average net worth of $10 million or more. When you look at the percentage of the gross national wealth that is accounted for by these particular families, it absolutely blows your socks off. And it doesn't matter, like I say, it doesn't matter how it's registered. The economic benefit, to the extent that there was any ever to this policy, has long since been exhausted. And even David Stockman, who was one of the chief supply-siders, when he was the chief of the Office of Management and Budget under Reagan, after he left in a huff because he thought that politics had come to dominate the Reagan administration, he gave this famous interview to William Grider in the Atlantic Monthly in which he said, look, supply side was always a fig leaf. He called it the Trojan horse. He said the object of supply side economics was simply to lower taxes on wealth. And the real goal of these people is to eliminate all taxes on wealth and all taxes on capital. It doesn't really have a coherent economic policy any longer. It is simply the accumulation of wealth for the accumulation of wealth's sake.
Let me ask about something you said in the beginning about the relationship to presidential power. And, you know, one of the things, you know, we do on this program, of course, is talk a lot about president essentially overriding all the checks and balances of Congress or the courts at everything from Guantanamo to torture to the war in Iraq, et cetera. And I've always, of course, looked at it as sort of a decline of empire, really, and the need to take that kind of power and increase militarism and all that and military spending. Can you explain a little more what you mean by that relationship of presidential power to the upward wealth that has been created in this country?
There are several different elements of the modern right. One of them are the neoconservatives. The neoconservatives have always been strong believers in a powerful presidency. They began to coalesce around the various think tanks and study groups in the late 1970s in response to what they thought was a weak foreign policy at the hands of Jimmy Carter. To the extent that you want a vigorous, muscular foreign policy, to that extent you want a vigorous and more powerful presidency. So in part, the rise of the neocons has signaled the rise of a powerful presidency. I think, though, a lot of the connection between what's going on now and the distribution of wealth and power is a function of what's been happening in the country since 9/11. You've got a particularly focused and ideologically coherent bunch of people at the center of state power. They're organized around a set of very, very clear policy objectives, all of which require the abandonment of traditional – I mean, I think you really can start talking about kind of proto-fascism here in the sense of an abandonment of the traditional separation of powers, an abandonment of many of the kind of cardinal tenets of bourgeois democracy. So the connection between the upward distribution of power on the one hand and the concentration of power in the hands of the presidency on the other is that as a regime matures and as it gets more and more radical, which this one has, it tends to retreat to its areas of institutional strengths. And that's what's been going on. I think what you're likely to find is that the results of the last election will register in the legislative branch to some extent, but Bush has made it very, very clear that as far as the electorate is concerned, it will have no impact whatever on the way he conducts the war. I do think, though, with all that's said and done, that the results of the election are likely to have some long-term breaking impact on the concentration of power in the presidency, if only because there comes a point when even a strong-willed president like this guy waging a very, very unpopular war is going to have to take account of the Congress. And I think that day is not long away.
John, let's roll the tape back 25 years. The United States has just come out of a defeat in Vietnam, its first defeat after the Second World War. And what are these people thinking? And what are they going to do? And how did they put this project together?
I'm not sure they had any idea how successful they were going to be. I mean, I think that's one thing about the way in which these kinds of movements develop. Hegel has this wonderful line in the Phenomenology when he says that an idea is right. He's a historicist, right? So he says an idea is right when it successfully comprehends its era in thought. Now, when you look back at the late 70s and the early 80s and you start to see the constituent elements of the right come together, I really don't think they had any idea how successful their attack on liberalism would be.
We thought they were a joke. I remember.
Yeah.
The Mandate for Change came out when Reagan took office, which was the Heritage Foundation, this stinky little think tank in Washington.
Exactly.
I never expected it to go anywhere. I was so appalled by Reagan and the Mandate for Change, and look what it is.
Look what it is.
I was on the University of Wisconsin campus in the 60s. Republican Youth, I can't remember what they were called. I agree with you, Michael. We thought they were a joke.
Yeah.
Turned out, not too long after that, these people actually had desks in the White House.
Well, the Federalist Society started around then, and they very cleverly groomed young lawyers to move up into positions high in the government.
So, but one question which you said is why, John, yes, it was an idea whose time they hit right, but why? Why was it the right idea at that point? Was it the end of the Vietnam War, beginning weakening of U.S. imperialism, whatever? I don't know.
It was a lot of things, which came together. I mean, I think all of us had a sense in the late 70s that there was something wrong. There was something that was just not right about this period, but I don't think any of us knew it until it happened later. There were a lot of things. It was Vietnam. It was the aftershocks of the great social movements of the 50s and 60s. It was the end of Keynesianism and of the New Deal consensus. All of these things came together in the ideological, political, and above all, the economic crisis of the late 1970s to produce a real possibility for a sea change. So you have these different pieces. I remember reading Jerry Falwell's book back then, and that came out in 1980. I said, who the hell is this guy? You know, who would listen to this clown? When you read his book, which I unfortunately had to do for my book a second time.
It's a living.
It's preposterous. It's absolutely preposterous. And yet, the moral, authoritarian, Southern-based right turns out to have been one of the enormously powerful political influences in the late 20th century history of the country.
We're speaking with Professor John Ehrenberg about his book, Servants of Wealth. What were the various pieces that they put together? It was the think tanks. It was the universities. It was the consolidation of the media. Tell our audience, John, what were these pieces that they put together to build this enormous engine of right-wing social change?
Well, what I did in the book is the story of how they put together the institutions has largely been told. What I try to do in the book, and I don't think that what I try to do in the book really has been told yet, is try to account for the ideological arguments that they put forward. Why? I mean, we were just talking about this. Why is it that a bunch of arguments that had formerly been the marginalized arguments of a backward, self-serving, narrow little right-wing elitist bunch of individuals, how come suddenly they acquire a mass base?
Well, tell us. Take a deep breath and take some time and tell us
what
these ideological arguments are.
There are five pieces to it. And I think one could have divided this pie up in any way one wanted. I mean, the right did advance on a very, very broad front over this period of time. I chose to divide its different armies, if you want, into five constituent pieces. And I really thought these were the important ways in which we were doing it. And I want to repeat that I don't think they really had a sense of how powerful they'd be. I'm not sure how much they cooperated with each other. In many ways, this coalition that makes up the right is highly unstable and is always under threat, like all coalitions are. But there were five, I think, essential pieces. The first were the neoconservatives, who come together around a critique of what they thought was a defeatist U.S. foreign policy at the end of the 1970s. And a lot of this does have to do with Vietnam. It has to do with changes in the United Nations. It has to do with what these people falsely, it turns out, alleged to have been a menacing series of threats from the Soviet Union. The first generation of these people come together in a series of organizations, the Coalition of Peace Through Strength and a whole bunch of other ones, to demand that the old Keynesian calculus of guns and butter be recalculated. And the claim was, we can't afford guns and butter anymore. Guns are more important than butter. Butter's going to have to yield. That was the essential argument. We can't have domestic social reform on the one hand and a militantly aggressive foreign policy on the other. So the latter is more important. So that was one piece of it. Was a critique of a weak-minded, democratic-led foreign policy. A second piece of it was the rise of a distinctly southern-based, religiously inspired right, which makes arguments about authority, about the breakdown of authority. And in particular, they made arguments about women and the breakdown of the so-called traditional nuclear family. But what really freaked people like Jerry Falwell and the likes of him out was the women's movement. And when you read the stuff they wrote about the women's movement, it's just beyond belief, the stuff that they're talking about when they describe Bella Abzug as a ranting lunatic, Betty Friedan as the ice-cold, man-hating feminist. I mean, it plays into the most appalling stereotypes. And yet, once again, for people who were threatened by these social movements, and in particular threatened by the direct challenges they posed to the old systems of authority, they resonated. One of the arguments I make, by the way, is that you can't account for the rise of the right by simply calling them liars, although many of them are thugs. You can't account for them by saying, well, they know how to frame things. You can't account for it by saying, well, the liberals collapsed. All of those things are true. And yet you don't get a 25-year period of ideological hegemony unless you can understand that it had a real mass base. And it really did. The right wing spoke to people's real fears at a time when the left had nothing to say. And even though they adopted the tactics in a sense of bait and switch, they raised real issues and then turned out to be servants of wealth, they still did say things that people responded to. So the first thing was weak foreign policy. The second thing was a breakdown of authority in the family, in society, in schools, and everywhere else. A third set of arguments pivots around race. The arguments around race and the need to discipline ungrateful, unruly blacks become very, very prominent in the late 70s and early 1980s. The claim is that equality before the law is as far as anybody should go in a decently organized society. Anything more than that is pandering to black male and the result of liberal weakness, and it's time to stand up to the blacks and insist that they behave themselves. Racism is dead. The right said it's time for people to hitch up their belts and get to work. Reagan invents this whole – you remember the Reagan notion of the wealthy mother on the Cadillac and the Cadillac, which was a fiction, by the way, but which totally expressed the prevailing suspicion of welfare as a government-funded handout to the parasitical, ungrateful, violent, dangerous black underclass.
What's the fourth and the fifth?
The fourth argument is an argument about the market. Fourth argument is an argument that – and this is really where the right stops being this kind of complaining backward-looking force and begins to cast itself as the forward-looking voice of economic opportunity and wealth creation and begins to say, well, it's the liberals who are the backward-looking party that's been captured by so-called special interests. So the fourth piece of it is that, hey, the market is where free people make individual autonomous choices. They enter into voluntary compacts with each other. This is Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman and all these guys. And social policy needs to be organized around loosening restraints upon the market and letting – Reagan used to get all dreamy-eyed when he talked about, you know, the magic of the market. And this is where the supply-siders come in with their desires for deregulation and privatization and cutting taxes on wealth. And the fifth element, which emerges rather recently, is an unapologetic defense of inequality in the name of meritocracy. Well, the market rewards those who deserve it. And if you're rich in the market, it's because you work harder, and maybe you're a little bit lucky, but you've worked harder and you deserve your wealth, and if you don't work hard, you can't possibly get ahead. So there's this, and this taps into a very, very old American tradition of the independent, small property-owning entrepreneur who makes his way in the world and ends up better off than he was when he began. None of these arguments were invented in a sense. I mean, they all really play into deep American positions, the most important of which for our purposes really is a tradition of anti-statism. The notion that the welfare state is inherently corrupt, the welfare state is inherently authoritarian. If left alone, it will tax more, it will regulate more, it'll take more of your stuff and give it to people who don't deserve it. You have to rein the state in and let free people do their thing. And you hear George Bush talking about the ownership society. This was back before 9/11, in much the same terms that Ronald Reagan used to talk about a society in which his idea of a just society was one in which everybody could get rich. When a reporter asked him what kind of society he wanted to lead as president, that's what he said. The notion of anti-statism draws upon one of the facts of American social history, which is that since the 1890s, every single redistributionist, social egalitarian trend in American history has been statist, in the sense it has relied upon the government to restrain the market, redistribute wealth, police the marketplace, and follow a policy of, generally speaking, more economic equality. So if you are anti-state, I mean, the whole notion of anti-statism is interesting given Dick Cheney and Ronald Rumsfeld and George Bush's notion of the unitary president, who can do anything he wants. But you have to distinguish between ideology and the arguments that make it in the ideological sphere and then the actual policies that are pursued.
Tell us a couple of questions I have, but certainly one I want to know is how did 9/11 affect these five pieces of the what you call the right or the plutocracy's push? And how do you see it going forward that these are actually being destroyed in some way or at least?
9/11 intensifies everything. And one of the things that 9/11 does is it delays the appearance of a corrective. Kevin Phillips has this notion of these broad cycles of American history where he says you get these periods of wealth concentration, and the two that he talks about in particular are the 1890s and the 1920s. And they're followed by periods of corrective policies, which tend to be more redistributionist and tend to be presided over by the Democrats. And everybody's been asking for the last period of time, where's the corrective? This has been going on for 25 years now. Where's the corrective? And my sense is that 9/11 simply delayed the appearance of the corrective for a couple of years. And that now maybe, and this may be, Michael, I mean, it may be that I'm more hopeful than you are that something new, some new set of policies are possible. But it's possible now that with the breaking of the ideological stranglehold that the Bush administration had on issues of terrorism and foreign policy, that it's possible that a real debate about economic matters can now be engaged in this country.
John Ehrenberg, author of Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Economic Justice. You can get the book anywhere, I guess, and it's published by Roman and Littlefield. This really gives you, you know, here we're dealing with everything, some of the results, but we're not dealing with the causes, and this is really tells us what is going on in this country for 25 years when I guess John and I and the rest of us on this show, at least a lot of us, grew up in the 60s at a time when we thought there was this great possibilities for really changing the country, and in many ways we did. Sure. And in many ways it's been trying to reverse itself for 25 years, and now maybe we're again at the beginning of a change. So, John, really, this was a terrific interview. Thank you.
Thank you, John.